We are honored to have Ian Bremmer on the phone with us. You may be familiar with this political scientist from his many TV appearances. He's also the foreign affairs columnist and editor-at-large for Time magazine, president and founder of Eurasia Group, a global political risk research and consulting firm, a professor at New York University, and author of 9 books, including his most recent, a New York Times bestseller, Us Versus Them, The Failure of Globalism. Ian Bremmer, thank you for being with us on the phone this morning.
My pleasure.
Let's start at the 30,000-foot level. How do you define globalism?
Globalism I would define as the political ideology promoted by the West, leaders in the West, started after World War II. We didn't want another war, where we did the Marshall Plan, we did the United Nations, rebuilt our enemies, aligned them with us. It was the idea that we were all one people, and so as a consequence, we wanted open borders, free trade, the United States and our allies promoting democracy and ensuring security with our troops all over the world, and that was going to be ultimately the most successful way for us to build the world order.
And you draw a distinction in the book, which, by the way, is a fantastic read, between globalism and globalization. And is globalization sort of an effect of globalism?
No, globalization is an economic process, and it's worked. Globalization is just the idea that if you have free trade globally, you bring goods and ideas and people all over the world to trade, that is going to reduce the price of those goods and leads to more growth. That's true. And that's what happened. Now, the fact of globalization, of course, means that some people lose. Some people lose their jobs because it's cheaper to produce elsewhere. But, you know, shareholders do much better. Companies do better. There's more growth. And so, you know, if for globalization to be effective, you need to make sure that the people that are losing, get benefits and aren't left behind by their governments. And, of course, that's something we've not done very effectively. So globalism is the political project. Globalization is just the economic reality.
And I take it that it is because of the failures that you just indicated in terms of helping the losers in a globalized world that has given rise to some of the us versus them sort of political movements that we've seen in recent years.
Absolutely. I mean, part of it is the economic front, the fact that the average American feels like they've not done as well, they've been left behind. Part of it is an anti-immigration backlash. You're not taking care of me and my family, but now you want me to bring in all these other people that feel different and talk different and have different cultures and values. Don't want that. Part of it is a reaction to all these wars we've been fighting, which have failed. Right, I mean, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, our track record's not been good. It's the enlisted men and women and their families that have been fighting and have done the ultimate sacrifice. They're not heroes when they come back. The Veterans Administration's broken. That's a big problem. And then on top of it, and perhaps the most worrying piece, is the fact that in the last 5 years, technology has displaced far more workers than globalization ever did. And technology has also driven people farther apart in the way we consume our news, because now you only actually read about and listen to people that you like, which has really undermined civic nationalism in our democratic system in a way that 25 years ago we thought about the internet. No one knows if you're a dog on the internet. You know, that was empowering people, gave you information, and was going to empower liberal democracy. That's why we had the Arab Spring. Not the way it works anymore with the data revolution, big data, information revolution. So for all of those reasons, you see a vastly greater divided society here in the United States and really across the West than at any point since we've been alive.
Well, it sounds pretty pessimistic, Ian. Where is this path leading us?
Well, it's the reason why it's pessimistic is because it's not a crisis for people in power. If it was, I think our governments would be addressing it. But it's not, because there's still so much wealth, and building walls is effective, right? I mean, so you look at the Chinese system, we used to think that once they became middle income, they'd have to reform and become more like us, or they'd fail. Turns out they've actually consolidated power. Xi Jinping's president for life. They've built much more effective digital walls. Everyone now has to like listen to and watch the same stuff, or they don't get economic opportunities, their social credit system, and it's working. When Trump says you want to see if walls work, go to Israel. Israel is a tremendous democracy. It works really well. It's one of the best in the world. They've got great rule of law, great independent media. It's not corrupt, right? I mean, it's very transparent. It even works if you're an Arab living in Israel, as long as you're not Palestinian. And the thing is, they've completely walled off the Palestinians. They can't get in. They don't need Palestinian labor. They've gotten even built walls underneath the ground with sensors so they can't tunnel through anymore. They've got a ceiling that's called the Iron Dome so they can't threaten them with Hezbollah missiles. In other words, you know, it's great to live in Israel as long as you don't think of the Palestinians as people. And if you're willing to do that, then the system is really good. And now we've elected someone in the United States that's very similar, someone who says, look, we need a wall with Mexico because otherwise they're going to come here and they're going to rape our women. They're going to criminalize us. And the Haitians are going to bring AIDS. And the Nigerians, if we let them in, they'll never go back to their huts. I mean, that's a very powerful message for a lot of people that feel like their own families haven't been taken care of for decades.
So wait a minute. Are you saying walls work?
Well, I mean, I don't want to live in a society like that, but of course I'm saying they work. They clearly work, right? I mean, that's part of the problem, is that you now have a country in China that's about to become the largest economy in the world. It's going to be authoritarian and state capitalist. It is a rejection of everything that we have stood for in the United States as a superpower, and it's doing it without any political reform. It's doing it by building stronger walls every day. Much more surveillance, no privacy for its people, and you do or don't get economic opportunities on the basis of how you behave. It's almost Orwellian.
Let's come back to the United States for just a minute and talk a little bit more about, we've talked about how sort of part of this reaction is due to economic circumstances and how they have changed over the last 25 years. But the second thing we've touched on just a little bit is culture. How would you characterize the culture threat that's creating an us versus them mentality here?
Well, I mean, in the United States, it's much more. It has been much more on the cultural side. It's been much more about a lot of people, a lot of white Americans, particularly some undereducated white Americans, that have felt that a lot of people have come in that are different from them, and they don't like it because they feel like no one is paying attention to them, and society's become more progressive, young people are more progressive, interested in LGBTQ rights and interested in, sort of having open borders, all these things, and what about them? There's not really a security issue in the United States, and historically the Americans have been better at integrating migrants than a lot of our Western counterparts have. So I would say that in the United States, the culture backlash is much smaller than it is in, say, Europe. Where in Europe, the economic piece is working pretty well. Germany, for example, the average German worker feels really good about their future. In Italy, in the north, the Italians feel pretty good. But they voted against Merkel and they voted against Berlusconi in the north of Italy because those migrants, Muslim migrants, came in and really didn't integrate, and society didn't do a good job integrating them.
In the U.S., the sort of culture, sort of strange people are coming in, they talk funny, they look different. That has sort of been linked largely to the election of Donald Trump. In other words, that the election of Donald Trump was in part a manifestation of that concern. Since then, we've obviously seen a lot of tumult and reaction to that. But I know that tomorrow in the West Virginia Senate primary, we see a character that sort of, to me, sort of out-Trumps Trump in the guise of Don Blankenship. Is that something? I mean, you have any observations about that West Virginia Senate primary? Have you been following that?
Yeah, I have. And I've seen his ads, the one that talked about the China family, sort of taking benefits. It's really, that's about as anti-globalist a direct message for a Senate race as I have seen in the country. It hits both the trade, the ideology, the culture, the system is rigged against you. I mean, it's pulling all of those emotional strings. Clearly, the Democrats feel like if he's able to win, that they're going to end up getting the seat. And in the Senate race in 2018 that is going to be extremely close, with the Republicans only with a two-seat majority right now, the Republicans need every seat they can keep. But, you know, the United States, these races, you know, are very different from state to state, from constituency to constituency. This problem is not, you know, equal everywhere you look. But there is clearly a very broad grassroots movement. And you didn't just see it with Trump. You saw it with Bernie Sanders, too.
Right.
And I'd even argue
or
you
left.
Saw it with Barack Obama, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of people that voted for Obama ended up voting for Trump. Those weren't people voting primarily on identity politics. Those were people that just wanted an outsider against the establishment.
It is interesting that this movement that seeks to turn back a threat to culture turns out to end up supporting candidates who are child molesters and convicted criminals. It's just extraordinary that is how this return to culture has manifested itself in these last two Senate races.
Look, I think facts are not on your side here, right? I mean, no, we know that Brexit was a vote in the UK, and everyone, whether it was the media or the intellectuals, the professors, they all said this is going to be worse for you. And yet the response was, look, you can take your fancy facts, but you have all been lying to me for decades, and I am going to protest vote because I need someone to recognize that this is not working for me and my family, and you need to take me seriously. And if I don't break something, you're not going to take me seriously. And I think that with Trump, it's the same thing. How could people be out there supporting as damaged an individual as Trump? He's not a role model. He's the antithesis of that. No one wants their kids to grow up like Trump. But the fact that the media keeps looking at these tweets and saying and fact-checking Trump and gotcha, you got it wrong, and we're smarter than you, and we know all these facts, that mainstream media has completely invalidated and delegitimized themselves in the eyes of everyone that voted for Trump, precisely because they're thinking, yeah, I'm going to support these guys in the media who use their facts and end up screwing me and my family yet again for another 10, 20 years. It's precisely that. That's why I voted for the guy in the first place. So I fear that the mainstream media, by getting into this fight, is really playing the game.
In case you are just joining us, you're listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. We're coming up on 9:20. We're talking to author Ian Bremmer. He just wrote Us Versus Them, The Failure of Globalism. And Ian, we know we've got to get you off the phone in 10 minutes, and we have so many questions to ask you. You have an interesting media group called G-Zero, and it's a new kind of media company with a simple mandate to help a broad global audience make sense of today's leaderless world, which again sounds pretty bleak. Who's going to emerge from this leaderless world, do you think?
You're going to have a period where government leaders are not impressing us. I mean, who's going to emerge? I'm a Catholic. And I think that the Catholic Church is one of the more damaged institutions out there, right? It's anti-science, it's anti-women, it's anti-gay. And yet Pope Francis is one of the most inspirational leaders in the world today. And in part it's because here's a guy that's willing to speak in an honest and authentic way about issues like global poverty and climate, and he resonates with just average people. Even that the institution isn't any good, when they see that the state leaders aren't doing well, they're going to reach out to someone like him. More people are supporting the Queen these days in the UK. She's been around for more than 50 years. Theresa May is considered a joke by absolutely everyone there. So, I mean, you wouldn't normally consider the monarchy to be a particularly great institution. They're not all that bright. They're obviously a little inbred. And yet, the Queen is someone who is seen as pretty rich. Trump's going to go over there. She's seen 13 presidents. She'll see another one. You know, who do you really care about? I think that, you know, we're finding a lot more inspiration and leadership in our own communities from people that we feel like we can touch, that we can talk to, that know us, that see us, that engage with us. But it's not going to be our political leaders. That system is increasingly broken, and that's what I wrote the book about.
And your book does have some optimism in it. You do leave us with some hope. And you mentioned the challenge of protecting democracy in this leaderless world. And if governments can't do it, maybe the private sector can. How can they do that?
the private sector and, you know, not just CEOs, also mayors and governors. I mean, you know, again, people that are closer to their own constituencies. And I think how they are doing it already is they're starting to experiment. So you're seeing small-scale experiments in universal basic income and with the gig economy, with more flexible working environments, but universal lifetime training. You're seeing Steve Case, the former CEO of America Online way back when, who's now developed a private equity firm to invest in startups in rural areas, so-called flyover states that otherwise never get the visits and the money from people that are looking for the traditional entrepreneurs. I'm seeing a lot of these small-scale grassroots experiments starting to pop up now, and they're popping up precisely because they see that government isn't getting it done, and we are so much more divided than we used to be.
You also see universities kind of stepping into the breach. How are they doing that?
I do. In Baltimore, Johns Hopkins University, together with a bunch of the business leaders, are trying to be to reach out and to connect between town and gown so that the university isn't some closed-off citadel on the hill. And since I wrote the book, a number of other cities in the United States have taken that as a worthwhile experiment that should be emulated. And so you see it happening in Pittsburgh and some other places. That's a great opportunity. I love the fact that since I wrote the book, the city of San Francisco has said that they're going to make community college education free for any resident that wants it. And, you know, if that is funded and those colleges have functional skills that continue to evolve as the world evolves, that could be a good outcome, right? So it's not as if we're helpless, but it is that our system right now feels a little broken and a little rigged, and we're going to have to get a little more creative in order to make this work for people.
One of the things that was interesting to me in the book was the way you looked at different categories of us versus them in different countries. In other words, while we saw many instances of this kind of dysfunction and distrust in government, there were different reasons for them and different manifestations of them. Could you talk a little bit about some of the other examples, like, say, Egypt or South Africa or even Saudi Arabia?
So I think you see this kind of populism manifest itself. I told you there are four reasons for it at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, across Latin America, for example, you go to Brazil and in Mexico, where there's a lot of anti-establishment sentiment, but it's not anti-globalization because they made a lot of money building their middle class from free trade. It's anti-corruption. There, they see the business class and the government in cahoots with each other, making enormous amount of money while they're not building basic infrastructure for the middle classes that have greater expectations. So as a consequence, you know, the bus system's broken down, the local policing is lousy, and so they're tossing the bums out. We'll see that with the Mexican elections coming up in a couple months. We're seeing it in Brazil with all of these impeachments, right? The thing that worries me the most is that as we see automation and big data displacing jobs, in the West, if you displace jobs, people aren't going to starve because we're wealthy. In emerging markets, these are the countries where precisely they got the jobs because they were cheaper compared to the West, and now they have these burgeoning middle classes. Well, they're the ones that are precisely in the greatest risk of being disenfranchised by all of this new technology, and they don't have the money, the social safety nets, the strength of political institutions to be really resilient when that hits. I think that's a wave that's really going to hit them in the next 5-10 years.
And you've got giant population centers like India and Indonesia, where, again, I think in the book you talked about, you know, how this threat could manifest itself in those countries.
Yes, absolutely. That, you know, the funny thing is that the Indians, for a long time, we really believe that the reason they'd be successful is because they're democratic, while the Chinese are not. What we're learning, the Chinese, if you have a whole bunch of people that are displaced because they're not efficient labor anymore, the Chinese government has the ability to hire enormous amounts of people that are inefficient. Like, look, we've got state-owned enterprises. They don't need to make money. We just need social stability. So if we're going to hire 10,000 people to build a canal, we're going to hire 10,000 people to build a canal. Doesn't mean if it's inefficient. India has a harder time doing that. So you see the Indians increasingly looking towards a more Chinese model, saying we need to be more top-down. We need to use universal ID and biometrics to actually drive a more centralized system outcome that might be less democratic, but allow us to continue to grow. It's a real question about what kind of government model that's going to work going forward. For the last 30 years, we in the West really believed that the future was going to be all of these countries that would be more aligned with us, right? They were all going to become liberal democratic over time. What we're finding is that it's really not moving in that direction.
And one of the more depressing things you discussed was South Africa, which I think everyone had enormous hope for after the peaceful post-apartheid transition, now looking down the barrel at another kind of social disconnect.
Yes, except they just had a positive surprise in the last couple of months. Mr. Ramaphosa, who was able to actually force Zuma out and is now directing an enormous and very dangerous anti-corruption campaign against Zuma and that entire political class. I mean, massive inequality in South Africa, some of the worst in the entire world, but they now have a president that, you know, better understands the economy and is trying to make things right. It's enormously difficult, but actually South Africa looks more upbeat and optimistic in their trajectory right now than they have at any point in over a decade.
Wow.
So, Ian Bremmer, we've got about 2 minutes left and one last question for you. Big decision facing Donald Trump right now about whether to pull the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear agreement. If you were the president's advisor, what would you tell him to do, and what do you think he will do?
It's hard to know what he's going to do. On this one in particular, because his people are all over the map, I would tell him to give a couple more months to his allies. The French, the Brits, the Germans have all said that they want to try to get a better deal for him. Something stronger that looks like it makes sense involving ballistic missiles. Can they do something? Look, if you break the deal right now, you're going to be isolated and alone, and everyone's going to be angry. You give them an extra 2 months, say, I heard you. Try to get something better for me. If it doesn't work, you blame them. If it does work, you're a hero. You're trying to do North Korea anyway. You don't need to complicate it. And by the way, with the deal in place, the Iranians are producing more oil. Oil prices are down. That's a tax benefit for the average worker. Ever since Trump's been talking about breaking it, oil prices are up at $70 right now. If he really cares about America first, he should start acting that way. If I were advising Trump, I'd say there's really no reason why you can't take a breath, put down the phone, and give it a couple months.
Ian Bremmer, author of Us Versus Them, The Failure of Globalism. Thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been really interesting.
Great to be with you guys.